derived a formula for the three-point amplitude, just based on general considerations and on Lorentz invariants. And we also looked at factorization, and we started the derivation of the BCFW equations, which we will finish today. Before we do that, though, I realized there was one comment that I didn't make. And since you're going to be seeing a lot of gravity amplitudes, and you also have seen the general form of the KLT relation, it's maybe nice to go back and look at the simplest possible gravity amplitude. So remember that we had started with an ansatz for the three-point amplitude that was, of course, homogeneous, as we argued, and involved the three possible spinner products. This was taking the solution where all the bracket products vanished in order to satisfy momentum conservation. And we found the solution that the exponents are given in terms of the helicities. E12 is H3 minus H1 minus H2, and the similar cyclic versions of that. So we considered the amplitude for a gluon, but we can also consider the amplitude for a graviton, for three gravitons. So instead of having the absolute values of the helicities be 1, we now have to look at the absolute values of the helicities being 2. Well, since these equations are homogeneous in the HI, it's very clear what the solution is going to be. We're just going to take the solution we had yesterday, namely the angle 1, 2 cubed divided by angle 2, 3, angle 3, 1, and square it. So this, in fact, is the three-point gravitational amplitude. And just as in gauge theory, we can, in principle, build up all tree amplitudes from knowing this once we've done the BCFW equations. For loop amplitudes, of course, in the pure gravity theory, then there are ultraviolet divergences, which cannot be absorbed into existing terms of the Lagrangian. So you have to decide what you're going to do with that. If you work in gravity theories with sufficient supersymmetry, then at least at low loop order, the theory is free of ultraviolet divergences. And if you now take not just the graviton amplitude, but you take the full supergravity multiplet, then you can use the unitarity techniques, which we'll start on today and we'll be spending tomorrow on, in order to calculate loop amplitudes. So this thing, of course, has now has a dimension. It has the wrong dimension for a three-point amplitude, so there's going to be a dimensionful coupling, but in gravity that's okay because we have a dimensionful coupling. So this is the very simplest form of the KLT relation, and this is one that, in fact, KLT did not write down because people were not thinking about things in terms of complex momenta at the time. Okay, so let's get back to the derivation of the BCFW or on-shell recursion relations. So we had introduced a deformation of the amplitude which we called bracket, L angle bracket, under which we shift J, the lambda tilde spinner associated with J, we subtract the lambda tilde spinner associated with L, and we shift the angle spinner of L in the opposite direction in a certain sense. We saw that momentum is conserved, so the sum of all momenta is of course equal to zero, and that equation is unchanged. Again, as a reminder, we're going to adopt the universal convention that all momenta are outgoing, so that we don't have to worry about the signs of that arise in momentum conservation. It means that in a physical process, in the physical region, some of the energies, of course, have to be negative. We also saw that even for the shifted legs, the on-shell conditions are left unchanged. So this thing is inducing a change in the amplitude to now an amplitude that depends on a parameter, but it's a perfectly valid on-shell amplitude just for a complex momenta. We made the assumption that which there are going to be, at least in the gauge theory, there are always going to be choices of J and L that allow you to satisfy this assumption that the amplitude falls off as we take this extra parameter off to infinity. And then we started to look at a contour integral. And that contour integral, write it in this form, A of z over z over some large circle, and where we're taking the size of that circle to infinity, or equivalently, we're taking a circle around the point at infinity. And we saw that the reason for considering that contour integral is it's very simple to evaluate because the amplitude is falling off as z goes to infinity. This contour integral vanishes. So that's we know that we're going to have something that's linear in the amplitude on one side. We're going to be able to, we hope, to solve for the amplitude in terms of other objects. And the way we can do that is to evaluate this contour integral in a second way, other than by knowing it's zero. We're going to evaluate it by residues. There's a pole at z equals zero, and the residue there, of course, is just the amplitude we're interested in, and that's very good because now the object we're trying to calculate is going to be in some linear equation with other things. We don't know that we can evaluate those other things yet, but patience. So in fact, we have the starting point, which says that this integral, the amplitude that we're interested in, the original amplitude, which is just setting z to zero, so we go back to our original momentum, is a sum over all poles that are other than the pole at zero, and we're going to take the residue of our integrand over there. So that's the point which we arrived at yesterday. And before I go on, I should ask, are there any questions? Okay. So overnight, everyone digested this? Yes?
So is the amplitude that you want, like, there's a question in the back of my mind about complex momentum and whether that's, like, the amplitude that we physically want is one with real momentum. So is there a certain limit that we take in the end for that as well?
So you'll see that the stopping point of this equation comes out naturally. But let's suppose that n is some number. You know, it might be 4 gluons or 5 gluons or 10 gluons, something like that. So this data, of course, is complex. But there's nothing that's stopping us from taking the bracket J and angle J to be complex conjugates up to a sign. So in other words, we can start with initial data in terms of the spinners that corresponds to real momentum. So the A0 here doesn't have to be, but it could be a genuine physical amplitude that's at some phase space point that you're ultimately going to integrate over and deliver some number to the experimenters. Okay. So there's no further limit that you could imagine. So or to phrase it differently, you could even imagine running this equation numerically. Okay? In which case, you just plug in the real momenta, you derive some spinners from that, and then just run this. Now, at the same time, I really want to encourage you to think of this thing not just as some number, but also as an analytic function of the different kinds of spinners. And so in that context, of course, you could start with complex momenta, and you could flow onto the real sheet, and you could flow back off, and so on and so forth. So you should really be keeping both of those pictures in mind. OK, so now we have to ask, what are the additional poles in this expression? And so what we need to do is to find the poles in A of Z. So there are two sources, potential sources of poles, but the basic source of poles is, of course, from factorization. So we need to have some intermediate momentum, some sum of intermediate momentum, let me say from kr up to ks, should go on shell. In fact, since we're taking a residue, we really need to be sitting exactly on the pole. So it's not just a question of approaching some factorization limit. We actually have to be sitting at a place where this invariant is actually zero. Okay, yeah, I suppose one should remind people to turn off their cell phones. I hope I've turned mine off. These, incidentally, we're essentially thinking of this in kind of a planar situation, because this amplitude here is a color-ordered amplitude, and so you can think of it as corresponding to planar diagrams. You don't need to have legs crossing over each other. You can unwind them because we have a color ordering. So these are consecutive sets of momenta. So there are two kinds of situations that we can, well, three maybe kinds of situations that we can have. The set that's going from R all the way to S can either contain neither of J and L, or it can contain one of J or L, or it can contain both of J and L. So here I can also interchange J and L. So the simplest case is where neither J and L are contained inside this set. And when that's true, first of all, this invariant is independent of Z. So as we move around in the complex plane, that invariant just stays fixed. On the other hand, it would be really very accidental if this invariant happened to vanish. That would mean we're sitting in some very, very special point in the space of external momenta. So if we have generic external momenta, if you just chose them, for example, at random or chose them in phase space or something like that, you would never find this invariant vanishing. And the same is actually true if both of J and L are members of this set, because the sum of J and L, again, is going to be independent of Z. So we're back in the same situation. We have no dependence on Z. This invariant is fixed, and generically, for a generic configuration of external momenta, non-exceptional one, it's not going to vanish. So that leaves us with a case where one of J and L is a member of this set R and S. And in that case, we can work out what happens to this momentum. So let's suppose it's J that's a member of this set, and L is not a member of the set. Then the set R through S, under that same deformation in Z, is going to have still the same original set of momenta, but it's going to be shifted by this vector, by the same vector that Kj was shifted. So built out of the other spinners. It's built out of the shifting spinners. Okay, so let's see what happens with the square of this guy. Well, there are going to be three terms, but this is, of course, a massless vector. We saw that when we looked at the square of Kj, so we don't have to worry about any term showing up in z squared. So this thing is going to go to the same invariant that we had before, and then there's the cross term, which is just minus z, and you can write it in this form, the slash here denoting, which I won't be generally putting in, but it's denoting a contraction with the sigma matrices. So this invariant is z-dependent, and moreover, as z is wandering around the complex plane, it's guaranteed to vanish somewhere. In fact, it's guaranteed to vanish at exactly one place. That place is given by solving this equation, saying that we ask for it to vanish, and we'll label the solution as ZRS, which is simply given by this ratio of the invariant to the contraction between the shift vector and this particular sum of momenta. So we know that all the poles have to be a pole in some invariant, but some of these potential poles don't actually show up because they won't appear for generic external momenta. On the other hand, independent of what the value of the external momenta are, these class of poles where you have one of the external momenta in this set and the other one not in the set are going to show up. So that means that the poles that we're summing over, these poles A, okay, can people still read the top of the screen if they need to? So we need to partition the set of legs. So we start out with legs 1 through n, and we need to partition it into two sets, one which contains J but does not contain L, and the other which, of course, does not contain J but does contain L. And then the summation over the poles A is simply the summation over all possible ways of partitioning the set. So the sum over the poles A is the sum of all the ways of partitioning in this fashion, where the shifted legs are on opposite sides. So we can, for each of these partitions, we can draw a picture. Pictures are always nice. So this is representing something. We don't know what it is yet. We're going to find out. So there's a something over here. And that something is attached to a subset of the legs in the complementary subset of legs are attached to another thing. And J is on one side, L is on the other side. So now we know that we're sitting exactly on the pole. It's on a pole in the amplitude. So we know that it's going to factorize. And we can sit exactly on the pole because we're taking the residue. So in fact, this object over here is going to be an amplitude. And this object over here is going to be an amplitude as well. So the residue that we're trying to calculate is going to be the residue when we put in all the appropriate factors of I of z, al of z, ar of z, there's an I, and we have the factor of z that came from the integrand, and then it's some pole that we're trying to address here, and we have a factor, because the thing in the denominator is has that factor still out front. So we can now go ahead and evaluate this residue. We have to evaluate it at this particular RS, and then the sum over partitionings is a sum over all the different ZRS. Well, that's easy enough because it's a simple pole. We just get to extract the coefficient of this thing, and we plug in ZRS everywhere else. So this thing is going to be minus I over ZRS, and it's A left of ZRS times A right of ZRS divided by J K RS L. So what does that actually mean, at least as far as AL is concerned? Well, we have a formula for ZRS. So, and what it says is that we have to take the left, this amplitude. Let's suppose for a second we actually have a formula, an analytic formula for that amplitude. It's going to have among its arguments, it's going to have, for example, a bracket J. Instead of supplying the bracket J argument, we're supposed to supply bracket J minus ZRS times bracket L. That doesn't change any of the properties of the amplitude in terms of momentum conservation or the on-shellness of the legs, but it's now in contrast to our starting point, this amplitude is going to have genuinely complex momentum arguments. So once you go beyond the first step in this development, then the arguments that you're giving here are completely fixed by the original external data. And again, for generic external momentum, they're going to end up being complex. Well, ZRS, we can plug in this formula. And this funny-looking spinner string cancels. So So we're going to have krs squared. And again, I should have labeled the legs here. They run from R to S. And since we're doing everything cyclically, this one runs from S plus 1 to R minus 1. And by momentum conservation, it doesn't really matter which set I chose. The invariant, of course, is the same. So we have the left amplitude evaluated at, changing notation here, ZRS. So we can write out a formula for our amplitude. And the other thing we have to do, remember that when we're looking at factorizations, we have to sum over all the different intermediate states in a given channel. And in the case of gluons, that just means summing over helicities. Because we're using the convention that helicities are always outgoing, it looks as though they flip across the line, but that really means helicity is conserved. So we need to sum over all the partitions of this sort and over the helicities of the intermediate leg. And we have an amplitude that has j hat on one side, j hat computed by plugging in for that particular partition the appropriate value of ZRS. Finally, there's the intermediate momentum, which one just gets by momentum conservation. This thing, again, is shifted. It's an on-shell momentum. The propagator denominator is of course, an off-shell momentum. It's a massive momentum. And then we have another amplitude on the right-hand side that corresponds to the complementary partition. And for those of you who are complaining that I'm hiding the formula as I'm writing it, just give me one second and I'll be out of your way. So that then says that we basically have to do a sum of this thing, of this picture here. We have a naive propagator that we put in the middle. And that's our formula for the original amplitude. So we're very close now because we have a formula for the original amplitude written in terms of momentum invariance and amplitude. So these are at least, they're not exotic objects, they're objects that we know. The last thing we want to do is just to do a quick counting. So this amplitude has to have at least three legs. And that means that this amplitude can have at most n minus 1 legs if we started with n legs. So in other words, we've derived a recursion relation because we've written our endpoint amplitude in terms, our on-shell endpoint amplitude in terms of simpler on-shell amplitudes. So we go from n to n minus 1 to n minus 2. Eventually, we come down to A3. In A3, we know what the formula is, so that's the end of the end of the line, and the recursion terminates there. Now, in general, you can see that there's actually going to be a quadratic number of terms in this sum, quadratic in n, because you have to sum over all partitions, so j can go from one end of the partition to the other, and at the same time, L is of course, doing the compensating thing. But if we chose j and L to be neighbors, which is much of the time possible, but not always possible, then, in fact, the number of terms is only going to be linear because instead of having to allow j to float around, j has to be stuck at one end of this set. And then the only question is there's only one index that decides how you partition the overall set of legs into two subsets.
hash there indicate like evaluated at R as Z or S?
Exactly, yes. I should have mentioned that. So X hat means X of Z RS.
Shouldn't that be P bar on the bottom?
So it's actually a P hat. Sorry.
But isn't that the amplitude representing the barred section? So shouldn't it be a function of the barred and the...
Well, I mean, the momentum conservation. So P bar, I mean, I'm using here P in two different senses, of course. So maybe I should have, I don't know, should have used it. A larger, different blackboard letter here or something like that. Momentum conservation ensures that, of course, the momentum coming out of P bar is exactly the negative of the momentum coming through P.
How would it happen that J and L cannot be chosen to do this?
For example, if... it can depend on the helicity patterns, and also, in fact, for gluons, it doesn't really happen. But in the fermionic cases, you may end up with situations where you cannot choose them as neighbors, because if a shift is shifting only fermionic lines, and they're different fermion lines such that there's no possible intermediate state that can go from one to the other, then you don't have a useful recursion for that particular amplitude. So the pound here is just counting the number of elements in the set P. And then the pound P bar is the number of elements in the set P bar. Remember, we have all the external legs in P here, and then there's one internal line. So it's exactly one more than the number. Okay, so one other thing that we should do is just to verify that we actually have legitimate shifts. And I'm just going to skim this argument, but the bottom line is, in the pure gauge theory, then you actually have a variety of shifts that are legitimate in the sense that A of Z goes to a zero as Z goes to infinity. There's recent work sort of explaining how you can get around this restriction, but at least for the simple form of the BCFW equation that I'm showing you here, you do need to do that. The argument, you can give an argument for these two helicities. It's a little bit more involved, but let's just try and look at the first of these, where you choose the minus plus shift. So, and this is an example of something where you can, there are different ways of arguing this, but one way of arguing it is to think about doing a Feynman diagram calculation. But you don't do it explicitly, you just argue about the general properties of a Feynman diagram calculation. So, we need to know that the three-point vertex in the Lagrangian is linear in momentum, linear in K. So that in turn means that it, in general, if we imagine looking at some string of vertices that start at J and go, there can be some other vertices, maybe three-point vertices, four-point vertices. So we're imagine tracing a path through a given Feynman diagram going from leg J to leg L. Generically, the momenta that we will encounter along that path are going to be proportional to Z. On the other hand, the momenta that are flowing through the propagators are also going to be shifted by z, but the shift vector is massless, so the denominators are going to be linear in z. So the propagators are going to go as 1 over z. The four-point vertices, those are just, look them up in your textbook, those are just g mu nu's, nothing gets shifted there. So those things are just going as order z to the 0. They just go as order 1. So the first thing we can see is that if we have, if we're trying to compare two different graphs, one that has, let's say, two three-point vertices, and one that has a four-point vertex, this one generically will go as z times 1 over z, so it's going to go as order z, whereas this thing, this vertex, is going to go as order z to the 0. So the leading diagrams, the ones that we have to worry about, are the ones that contain only three-point vertices, because every time we have a four-point vertex, we know it's going to be subleading to some other diagram that we can write down. Okay, so what's left to do now is to count the vertices as we're going along. And if you think about it, there's always going to be one more vertex than there is a propagator. If I start with this basic structure and I just keep adding three-point vertices, then every time I add a three-point vertex, I also add a propagator. So that diagram is going to be going, the diagram, the worst diagram in a sense, or the leading diagram, is going to be going as z goes to infinity. So what's the ingredient that I've forgotten here? Does anyone see? So what have I not put in here? Bingo. So we now go back to the polarization vectors that I introduced yesterday. Let me just remind you of their form. So now it matters whether we're doing minus plus or plus minus. We're doing minus plus, so JL. So J, the J shift vector is negative helicity one, so this one is choosing, let's say, the same reference momentum. The reference momentum doesn't really matter here too much. It's going to be have a bracket product in the denominator, an angle product in the numerator. And the plus helicity for L is going to be exactly the opposite way around. We're going to have a bracket L in the numerator and an angle L in the denominator. So now, if I do the shift, there's my orange chalk. I can just do that here. I can put that in here. Just extend the bar a little bit. We have that in here, and here we're going to have a term again proportional to z. So for this particular choice, in fact, the numerator is unchanged. The denominator acquires a linear dependence in z. So this thing actually is going to go as 1 over z squared. So overall, it's 1 over z.
So why isn't the numerator
changing with this shift? So this is an angle, J.
Oh, I see.
And the shift, so very good question. One has to be careful about this. So I didn't emphasize the fact, but J, the lambda spinner for J is not getting shifted. The bracket spinner for L is also not getting shifted. But suppose we were to have done the opposite shift, a plus minus instead of a minus plus. Then, in fact, I would be swapping these two helicities. I'd be swapping the forms of these things. Then I would have, for example, a q mu j over here and an l mu q over here. Then it would be exactly the opposite way around. It's the numerators that would be getting shifted. The denominators would be left unshifted. All of a sudden, instead of a 1 over z squared, I'd be getting a z cubed. And so that shift does not satisfy the requirements. So the plus minus shift does not give a suitably vanishing So one can run through similar arguments, although they're a little bit more involved because you have to kind of iterate them for the other two helicities, but again, they have adequate behavior. So as an exercise, I may have given this exercise yesterday, but how many people have actually done any of the exercises that I suggested? Were they trivial, easy, head scratchers? Okay, so some of them were trivial and some of them you actually had to work a little bit. Good. So exercise, show the large Z behavior for the different shifts. In the MHV and MHV bar amplitudes. And of course, the formulas, if you didn't write them down during Song He's lectures, you'll be seeing in a few minutes here. OK, it's always nice to do an example. Let's do an example. So I'm not going to talk explicitly about fermions or about massive particles, but as you can see from the kind of very general nature of the requirements here that you can imagine that it can be done in those cases, and that is in fact the case. So let's look at a very simple amplitude, at a four-point amplitude, with a minus minus plus plus helicity pattern, and we're going to pick a 2-3 shift. Precisely the pattern that we just demonstrated is a good pattern for the purposes of the assumption. And again, it's the bracket 2 spinner that's getting shifted, and the angle 3 spinner that is in a sense shifted in the opposite direction. And again, just to remind you, the angle 2 spinner and the bracket 3 spinner are left untouched. Okay, so we need to partition the set 1, 2, 3, 4 into two different subsets, such that 2 is in one and 3 is in the other. And moreover, we have to have at least two particles so that we have a non-trivial amplitude in each subset. So I think this is something that you can even ask your first grader to do, although you might not use this fancy notation. You might just put a set of marbles out and have them numbered or something like that. So we can the two sets that we want are 1, 2, and 3, 4. Again, we have to keep the color ordering. So in this case, we just have a single diagram, and we can start to write it down. So there's going to be a hat because at least one of these spinners is shifted. Remember that we're now sitting on the pole, and each of these amplitudes has to have a complex momentum. So let's see here. I think I've actually used minus p as the label here. And we have a 1 over the naive invariant, which I'm going to write as S3, 4. But of course, you could write it as S1, 2. They're the same thing. And here we have 3 shifted, and 4, of course, is unshifted. So first of all, we can see right away here that it's a very good thing that the momenta have to be complex now, because otherwise these three-point amplitudes would simply vanish, and that would not give us the right answer. We still have to do the helicity sum over the internal line, but that's easy in this case because, remember, the minus, minus, minus amplitude vanishes. So there's only one possible helicity assignment in this case. And here it's going to be a p hat. So if this is going to be a plus, then this guy is going to be a minus because the momentum is directed in the opposite way. And that's, fortunately, there is also a plus, plus, minus non-vanishing amplitude. So we have a non-vanishing result. We can see, incidentally, that if instead of minus, minus, plus, plus, I were to choose, for example, the all minus situation, then you could see right away that this thing would just give you 0. And we know what these three-point amplitudes are. So let me actually shift that up so people can look at the diagrams. So now we just have to write down the three-point amplitudes from yesterday. So we have 1, 2 cubed. I'm not going to bother putting a hat on the 2 here because the angle 2 spinner is not shifted. So 2 hat and 2 are the same thing. P hat is a massless momentum, so I can stick him as an argument. I mean, there's a spinner associated with him, which I can contract with the spinners for the other external legs. And there's this formula on the one-hand side, and let me put in the I that I did not write down over there. And remember that the coefficient in front of the MHV bar amplitude, this is an MHV bar class amplitude, actually is minus I. So again, we have 3, 4 cubed. Again, no need to write down the hats. Except for on the p's. So the first thing we have to think about is what exactly does this thing mean? And you think about contracting the negative of a momentum with some spinner string, then obviously you should get negative of the contraction of the original momentum. So if you're going to split that minus sign between the bracket product and the angle product, each one is going to give a factor of I. And that, as it turns out, is a consistent convention. So we can simply send that to I times p hat. And overall, that's going to give us a factor of minus I. Let me just copy the numerator factors here. Let me rewrite this as the bracket product as the angle product times the bracket product. And we can start to cancel some things here. So there are different things we could do now. We could simply plug in values of, figure out what p hat was and plug in the values of z. But as it turns out, in at least some practical calculations, there's slicker ways of proceeding. So I can put these two together to form a spin or string. And there are two different ways of doing it. I encourage you to do the other way as an exercise. I'm going to do it in this form. So once I've taken the minus sign out, then I just have a p hat here and a p hat here. I can put them together. So for example, I can take the 1 p hat and the p hat 3 and put them together. And likewise for the 2 p hat and 4. Of course, I could have done it the other way as well. I could have done 1 p hat 4, 2 p hat 3. The reason that it's convenient to do it this way is that we notice that p hat is equal to the sum of momentum. So this is just k, k 1, 2. And there's some z which we could solve for. But in this case, as it turns out, we won't actually need to do that. It's shifted by this vector that's built up out of angle j and bracket 3. So if I now substitute this formula into this vector over here, then you'll notice that I have when I do the Fierce identity, I have a common bracket spinner, or here I have a common angle spinner. So this term will actually vanish. If I did it the other way, 1 p hat 4, then there'd be a non-trivial Fierce, and I'd actually have to figure out what the value of z0 is. So in general, you have no choice. You actually have to do that. But in this particular case, you can be a little bit slick. So that means that because the Fierce involves a vanishing spinner product, so this term will actually vanish. We can simply plug in the value of the momentum. And we then have minus I times 1, 2 cubed, 3, 4 squared. Times 1 p 3 2 p 4. So p is k 1 2, but of course we can use momentum conservation to write it as minus k 3 4 instead. And when we do that, we're going to get a 1, 4 here. The 3 term, of course, again, is going to have a vanishing spinner product. The 4 term over here is going to have a vanishing spinner product. So here, it's K4 that will survive. And here, it's K3 that will survive. And we can now get rid of a couple more factors at the cost of a minus sign. And if we now rearrange what we have over here, we basically need to flip these two spinner products into a canonical form. Then we find 1, 2 cubed divided by 2, 3, angle 3, 4, angle 4, 1, which by now all of you recognize as the n equals 4 result for the MHV amplitude. It's the n equals 4 form of what's often called the Park-Taylor amplitude. In fact, this is not such a hard exercise to do, even with Feynman diagrams, if you make use of the spinner helicity basis that you saw in both of our lectures, Sung-hae and my lectures yesterday. But when you go to higher points, then that becomes more, I would say, of an ordeal. And this way is certainly a lot slicker. So as you've already seen, this formula generalizes. To the so-called Park-Taylor formula. Where if you have two negative helicities, you have a fourth power of the angle product of the two negative helicities, and then the cyclic spinner product in the denominator. So the exercise is to derive this. Using BCFW. And the hint, of course, is to do it by induction. I've already done the starting point for you, or you could pretend that A3 is the starting point if you wanted to do that. So the one thing that you may want to know about this formula is that it's actually a great example of the Arnold principle. Namely, this is named after a Russian mathematician, that namely things are not named after the people who actually wrote them down. So this formula in this form was actually written down by Michelangelo Mangano, Zhang Shu, and Stephen Park. So it was, of course, based on earlier work of Park and Taylor, and you can argue that the kind of key work was, in fact, done by Park and Taylor, but this formula itself was not. The supersymmetric version of this formula, which essentially just adds replaces the numerator with a supersymmetric delta function, is called the Nair-Park-Taylor formula, after Parameshwar Nair, who's the guy who first realized that you can think of these denominators as correlators. And again, this is the simplest amplitude with two negative helicities that is non-vanishing, because if you have only one negative helicity or no negative helicities, then the amplitudes vanish. And that's, again, something that's pretty trivial to prove using BCFW. So at this point, in principle, you actually know how to start without a Lagrangian, derive the basic interaction vertex, and then go on to calculate all tree amplitudes. And one of the exercises, another exercise that you can do, is really to start from nothing and derive the one of the super partners to this amplitude. Let's say if you have one gluino pair and the remaining particles being gluons. Are there any questions? Okay. So if not, then let's get started on unitarity. So from a practical point of view, there's one maybe last comment I should make about BCFW, which is that paradoxically, it's not actually the most efficient way of computing amplitudes as you go to large number of external legs. So it's, for small numbers of external legs, it's certainly the best way of getting compact analytic formula, and in fact, you can solve these recursion relations in the supersymmetric theory in kind of enclosed form. But it turns out that because the shifts are changing as you go down the recursion, it means that the, in some sense, the number of different quantities you have to calculate is still growing exponentially with the number of external legs. Whereas if you use an off-shell recursion like that of Berenson-Hiele, then it turns out that you can limit yourself to a polynomial number of the quantities that you need to calculate, at least for a fixed helicity pattern. And so in the large n limit, actually the Berenson-Hiele recursion is going to be more familiar. How is going to be more efficient? How many people here are familiar with the Berenson-Hiele? Oh my goodness. Okay, well, I don't think there will be, at least I had not planned to set aside time to talk about it, but maybe if there's some discussion session in the evening and people are curious, then I can tell you a little bit about it. So we now want to move on to computing one-loop amplitudes, or loop amplitudes more generally. And we'll spend the rest of today and all of tomorrow and a bit of Friday on certainly on one-loop unitarity. And the first thing that I want to do is not so much launch directly into the modern formalism, but to give you a little bit of an understanding of why it should work and how it works. And then we'll come on to a more modern formulation that we won't get to today. We'll have to wait till tomorrow. So there's a little bit of kind of a historical flavor to some of this introduction. So just as the case for factorization, unitarity is a basic property of a quantum field theory. Just says that probability is conserved. So if we have a scattering matrix, taken the complete set of states, and then we go through some interactions, and then we determine what the outgoing states are, then that matrix has to be unitary. That is, the S dagger S has to be equal to 1. So most of the time, at least in weakly coupled perturbation theory, nothing happens, and nothing is generally not very interesting. So what we actually want to write it is in terms of the transfer matrix, and that transfer matrix is defined to be interesting things that do happen. And if we simply write out this equation in terms of the transfer matrix, then we find the following result, that minus I times t minus t dagger is equal to t dagger t. And that's already a very interesting equation, and it kind of contains the seeds of a conceptual understanding of how everything can work. So first of all, roughly speaking, we can write this as twice times the imaginary part here, and I put it in quotes because strictly speaking, that's actually not correct. Because there are phase conventions and things like that which don't really affect this relation. And for some state, that's given in terms of some sum over intermediate states. And the thing that's interesting about it is that these are intrinsically look as though they're different orders in perturbation theory. This thing is, let's say, at tree level, but this thing is now going to be a square of tree level. So in fact, this thing can't show up at tree level. There's not going to be any contribution here. If this thing is a square of tree level, we already have to go to the one loop order in order to find something non-vanishing here. But then that tells us that just from knowing tree level quantities, we can get some information about a loop amplitude. So if we actually put in the Feynman I epsilon prescription, then we can write this a little bit more carefully in terms of the discontinuity. Discontinuity in the sense of crossing a branch cut of the transfer matrix in terms of its square. So we know something about the discontinuity or the so-called absorptive part, but that's not all we need. If we actually want to do some NLO calculation, then we actually also need to know the so-called dispersive or the real part of the transfer matrix. And basically the name of the game is how to derive that information with as little work as possible. Because at the end of the day, physicists are lazy, right? We want to get as much bang for the buck as we can. So the first thing we can imagine doing is going back to the optical theorem and reconstructing it using dispersion relations. So we would have some relation of this sort. I don't actually claim that all the signs are right here because it's just meant to be figurative. So we have the principal value of some integral, and we're going to go from the imaginary part by doing an appropriate integral along the real axis, and then we have to close the contour, and that gives rise to potential constants coming from the behavior at infinity. And these are so-called subtraction terms, which are related to the UV property of the theory. And generically, of course, the theories we're interested in, even if they're renormalizable, they have ultraviolet divergences. We can absorb them in order to define the coupling, but we still have them there. So this is kind of the very, very toy version of unitarity. You might call it version zero of the unitarity method. It's kind of like a pre-alpha test, something you don't actually show in public, but you look at in order to convince yourself you know what you're doing. And so if we have some branch cut over here, then basically what we want to do is go from that knowledge of that branch cut, just some constant, to an actual functional form. And at least the real part of that will simply be, in this case, a logarithm. But even if this picture is way too trivial to capture, you know, the full kind of structure of an amplitude, the key idea is still here, is that we want to think of these amplitudes as analytic functions, and unitarity is ultimately what will then let us determine the complete amplitude, the complete one-loop amplitude, in terms of its analytic structure. So the next step is to go back and, of course, think about integrals, think about Feynman integrals, because as I'd explained in the initial lecture, even if we don't want to actually compute any Feynman diagrams, the only Feynman diagrams we want to use are in general proofs, then Feynman integrals are still essential, and in fact, in order to do real computations, you have to know how to compute them. And that's something which was done a long time ago at one loop, so we don't really need to, I won't be spending any time talking about it, but it's still an active area of research at two and higher loops. So let's start by thinking a little bit about scalar theory, so we can just think about the integrals without having to worry about complicated numerator factors and vertices and things like that. So we know that we have a bunch of propagators. If we write down some, doesn't even matter, it could be some higher loop diagram. We have an integral over some rational functions at the end of the day. And so the question is, we're trying to find some branch cuts in the result of that integration. Where are those going to arise? Well, they're going to arise from places where there are poles in the integrand, and then those poles are in a sense going to get smeared out into branch cuts by the integration. So if we want to, again, still be very, very heuristic, and I hope there are no mathematicians in the audience, otherwise they may have a heart attack, we can imagine pushing the discontinuity operator through the integration, really not a legitimate thing to do, but we're just trying to get a heuristic idea of the properties that we're going to get and the formulas that we're going to get. So then the only thing that's left in the integrand are, of course, the propagators, and those all have the form of x plus I epsilon, the Feynman I epsilon, where x is something like a momentum squared or a momentum squared minus the line's mass squared. And generally speaking, I'm going to suppress all the Feynman I epsilons, but here it's actually important to do that. Well, this is a simple enough function that we don't have to worry about all the extra phases. We can just take the part above the branch cut, the part below the branch cut, and then divide by the 2i. So then we have a formula that looks something like this, x plus ii, I epsilon, and then x minus I epsilon. And of course, this is just a little bit of algebra. And we have minus epsilon divided by x squared plus epsilon squared. And this is all, of course, under the assumption that, or we're interested in this, in the limit that epsilon is positive but going to zero. So this is a very curious function. I hope that you're all not too far removed from your undergraduate mathematical physics course so that you recognize, how many people actually recognize what this thing is? Okay, good, so you're not that far removed. But for those of you who may not instantly recognize it, then as long as x is non-zero, then we can simply take epsilon to zero, everything is smooth and we get zero. But if x is actually zero, then we get 1 over epsilon, and then the thing blows up. So the only thing that you actually have to do a little calculation to do, and I of course am lazy enough that I did it in Mathematica, then this is going to give you simply a delta function of x. So what we expect is that we have this integral function, all these propagators, and then when we are looking for discontinuities, we're going to poke into the integral and set certain lines on shell. On shell is good because things become gauge invariant. We have a nice technology for dealing with things at tree level, and so this is the way we're going to develop a similar nice technology for doing things at loop level. So in fact, people long ago, before even I was born, had worked this out. In fact, there's a very nice fellow named Dick Kutkuski, who unfortunately died about 20 years ago, who worked this out in the beginning of the 1960s and gave precise rules for how to compute the discontinuities of a given general Feynman diagram. So we can imagine we have some Feynman diagram with a number of loops. And it can have many legs. Of course, there are many, many invariants here, just as we had to confront in the case of the BCFW. You can imagine that it's an analytic function of many, many different momentum invariants. And so if we're looking in some specific channel, let me call this set of momenta, let's say, running from, what labeling did I use here? I think I used A to B here. So if we call this k, then the rule for taking a discontinuity in the k-squared channel, so imagine being above the branch cut in k-squared, you know, some multi-particle invariant that generalizes s, and below the branch cut, then this thing is going to be given in terms of a sum over all cuts that isolate k. And let's see if I can actually, my artistic skills are capable of reproducing more or less the same thing on the right-hand side. It's supposed to be, even if it doesn't look that way. So we want to sum over all the cuts that isolate this channel on one side of the diagram. And the right-hand side we need to conjugate. So on the right-hand side, we're going to take I epsilon plus I epsilon to minus I epsilon, and whatever I's there are in the propagators go to minus I. I'm going to be sloppy and not keep writing that conjugation as we go on because it doesn't actually enter any explicit formulas that we're interested in. So you have to sum over all the cuts, and for each cut, every propagator that you cut, you're going to replace the propagator essentially by a delta function. It's not exactly the naive delta function that I wrote down earlier. It's an on-shell delta function of a special type. And what that special type is that it requires that the energy of the state be positive. And I shouldn't actually have changed notation midstream. This is supposed to be an L squared, excuse me. So that's the general formula, and let me just write down the formula at one loop. So we have discontinuity in the k-squared channel. We have some loop integral, let's say with a loop momentum, and then some number of legs that we're calling. So again, this notation, I guess I didn't really define it carefully earlier, is the sum of all momentum running from A to B inclusively. And again, we are ordering things in a cyclic form. I guess I'm doing it anti-cyclically. Oh, well. Anyway, so we have to sum over, there's only going to be now one way of cutting this particular diagram. So this discontinuity is simply given by this cut of the integral. And and we will see tomorrow how to rewrite this thing in a simpler form, and then also how to reverse this process, which is really what the unitarity method is about. So let me actually stop here, and we'll continue with this tomorrow.
Any questions before we drink coffee?
Yes.
The whole BCFW method seems very, I would have never made it up myself, kind of situation. I was just wondering whether there was an alternative you could think people thought about also that kind of is it proven that's the best way to do this kind of thing, or people look at other possible alternatives?
Well, there isn't what the best way is depends on what you're trying to accomplish. And as I mentioned in my comments, in spite of the fact that it's on-shell and slick and has all this high-powered machinery, if you look at the large n limit, it's not actually the most efficient way to compute things. And on the other hand, it's a method that you can run both analytically and numerically. And it's a method that gives you a great deal of insight upon which people have built the Grassmannians. And there's a lot of insight into the analytic structure that you don't get just from grinding out, let's say, the Behrens-Hille recursions. So I think it's a tool that should be in your toolbox. And more generally, the philosophy that I take is that I want to have as many tools in my toolbox as possible. And there's not always a single method. There may be a single picture that I have of kind of the global approach I want to take to things, but there's not a single method that I'm going to use as a hammer on all possible problems. I'm going to try to pick the right tool for different different problems. So.
Kind of comment on something on the smooth circuit version? Is there a direct way to derive the intuition?
The supersymmetric version of BCFW essentially replaces amplitudes with, or replaces the external states with supermultiplets. So you have, you know, the Grassmann variables and things like that, and it's very slick, and you can do a lot of things all together, but you also have to carry a little bit more notation, and I would have to spend 30 minutes explaining what the supermultiplet was and so on and so forth. And I encourage you to look at it. I don't actually have the reference on me, but there's a very nice a monograph by Henrietta Elvang and Yutin Huang, which is, I think, actually already published as a book by Cambridge University Press. So I encourage you all to buy it, and more. And if you feel you can't afford it, I definitely encourage you to pester your university library or physics department library, to the extent that such a thing still exists, to buy the book. So you should definitely read about the supersymmetric BCFW in there. So one of the things that you can do with the supersymmetric, the n equals 4 supersymmetric version of the BCFW, is you can demonstrate this dual conformal invariance, because it's a recursive structure. So this additional symmetry that's not manifest in the Lagrangian but is can be made manifest at the level of amplitudes. The other thing that's maybe a little bit subtle is that you can mix up the Grassmann parameters into the shift, and that's kind of a novelty. But I think the key ideas of the BCFW proof for the supersymmetric case, they're essentially the same as over here. I mean, instead of summing over plus and minus, you have to sum over the supermultiplet, and you can sum over the supermultiplet in a very elegant formal way by integrating over the internal Grassmann parameter. But I don't think that really gives you a great deal of extra insight as to how this thing is working. So the thing that's not obvious from the simple example that I did, especially because of the kind of slick way that I chose to do it, is that one of the things that BCFW is doing for you is it's you can think of it as kind of partial fractioning your amplitude. So each diagram in BCFW may have, in fact, unphysical poles, but it's when you add them together that you get something that's physical. But there can be interesting integration by parts identities between different ways of choosing shifts and things like that. And that invariance in itself also teaches you something about the structure of the amplitude.